right, folks, welcome back to the Game Trail Podcast. I got a guest on today, as promised last week. I got an episode uploaded, and this week I got a guest on. I'm going to introduce him here in a sec. Before I do that, I need to hit you guys with some promos. You guys can sign up for a Go Hunt Insider account. You can use the promo code GAMETRAIL, that's GAMETRAIL. If you do that, you're going to get 50 points back in the Go Hunt gear shop. I actually believe when this episode goes out, you still might have a chance to get 30% off an Insider membership if you sign up with that promo code. So like I said, use that promo code GAMETRAIL. Also, you can use that for a discount on products in the Go Hunt gear shop. Almost all the brands that we carry, you'll get 10% off if you use that promo code. And then shout out to Matthews Archery. Those guys are kind enough. I've said it before, but those guys have been great to me. Good to sponsor my podcast. So with that, I'm just going to dive in real quick. I'm actually really interested in talking to Earl today. Earl, how do you pronounce your last name?
Shro.
Okay. Yep. I didn't want to screw it up too bad, so I figured I'd just let you run with it. But
you're good.
Yeah, Earl Shroff from over to Cutter Stabilizers. We just recently started carrying you guys' stabilizers in the gear shop. I know that we spent some time with you guys last year. Our booths were kind of kitty corner from each other at the TAC event in Salt Lake, so we spent some time shooting the shit and hanging out. I've been aware of you guys' stabilizers for a long time. Kind of following along with your company and watching it build and grow and seeing what you guys are doing. But, I'm always tinkering with stabilizers and I get a ton of questions about stabilizers, probably not near as many as you do, I would bet, I'm stoked to talk to you because I think it's a fun topic to kick around, talk stabilizers. I'm super interested to see what I can learn from you, about my own stabilizer setup and what I might be able to do. So, I appreciate you jumping on. With that, I'm gonna let you do a brief introduction, and you don't got to go too deep. I'm mostly interested in how Cutter got started, and what's your role over there.
Yeah, absolutely. So, a little bit about me. I am the founder and the CEO, the basically everything up until last year. We actually just hired a younger kid on named Isaac to kind of run the daily operations, but. Basically, from 2019 to 2023, I was the wearer of all hats Cutter. So I do all the design work. I do a lot of the manufacturing stuff. Pretty much, if it's involved in the daily operations of running the business, I'm involved in it at some capacity. Aside from that, I mean, Cutter started basically as a little passion deal. You know, I started dip my toes into the water of working in the hunting industry in big box store during COVID. Essentially, I was managing the archery department over at a Sportsman's Warehouse, and then running a retail store during the pandemic. It was a shit show. You know, like it was crazy. You know, as retail stores go. You know, you kind of have a role in other departments. So, I mean, I was 90% working in the firearms area, which, man, I saw some shit during COVID in the gun department. I'll tell you
that. Really?
Crazy. Oh, my gosh. It's crazy.
Lined out the door?
Oh, dude. I remember I showed up one day to work, and I look back there, and there's literally a line, like, from the gun counter halfway out to, like, the middle of the store. I'm like, what the hell is going on? And I mean, you know how, you remember how it was. It was like this shit just kind of, there was a switch that flipped and it was like madness activated. And then just everybody was, I need a gun. What caliber of ammo do you have? I'll take one of those. I was like, holy shit. And there's like these people that have never touched a gun before, you know, all these people that are no idea what they're doing. And I'm like, yeah. I don't want to give you this thing, but
yeah,
I mean, so. That's kind of the beginning of it. And I worked in the archery world a little bit before that too, but retail pay or lack thereof led me to a different industry, and that was the manufacturing industry. So I was working in a machine shop for a robotics company, building parts on lathe and mill and CNC and all that stuff. So, I mean, it was cool. It was challenging, but at the end of the day, you know, my passions lied in the archery world, in the bow hunting world. Yeah, you know, I grew up hunting with a bow, shooting a bow. I think this is like my 22nd year bow hunting. So I've been doing it since I was basically old enough to do it. And the idea kind of came around to, you know, I have this little piece of carbon laying around from, I couldn't tell you what, but I just made a stabilizer. And I was like, this is pretty neat. And then it was kind of at the very beginning of the micro diameter stabilizer push, if you will.
Yep.
So I had some people close to me that advised me to try and see what I could do with making a micro diameter bar. And, you know, we did. And it was this constant process of just not being satisfied with what we had done until it was the most badass thing available. Mm-hmm. And, you know, that's kind of where we've led today. And it started with the bars. Now we have the mounts, you know, the front QD, the back bar bracket, we have the bow stand. We actually just launched a quiver, which was it's actually going to start shipping today, which
nice.
I mean, the deal with all of our products is they're in R&D and testing for a really long time before they launch. So it's like, I come up with this thing and by the time it's ready to sell, it's like an 18-year-old kid. I'm like, you need to get the hell out of my house and then go out on your own. You know,
it's
cool to see that progression, but I think it's important to the brand, to the business as a whole, is we're bow hunters first. We're perfectionists. We're hardcore. We push our gear. We try hard. We make the most of our time. We make the most of our opportunities, and our gear needs to be able to stand up to that. So, you know, you're probably the same way. You spend enough time in this world, and the tinkering of trying different stuff, it kind of goes away because you know what works.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, there's a couple different roles, if you will, of consumers in the hunting world. There's the people that pick their bow up a couple weeks before season and go do their thing and spend their vacation time and then come home. And there's the guys like us that are obsessing over it, that are tailoring their entire lives around going out there and spending as much time in the wild bow hunting as you possibly can. And that's kind of our customer base that appreciates the time and the effort that we put into these products. And I mean, again, like every single piece, part, and process is sourced from within the United States. We don't import or outsource anything. So it's not the best, most profitable business model, but I mean, it's important, dude. And like, we'll never do it any other ways as long as we can stay in business.
Yeah. I was curious to that point, like a couple things. One, why, the process must be pretty hard, right? To like, get all your parts and pieces manufactured in the United States, and then also to put them together, build them, and kick them out the door. I'm sure that's like a challenging process. So I was curious as to one thing, why that's important to you. And then two, I don't know if this goes right along with that question, but I am curious about where you got the name Cutter and where you landed on the logo. So the pronghorn. So I don't know if you can see, but you know, I've got some cutters here in the back. But yeah, I dig your guys's branding. So I love the pronghorn. I think it's super cool. So I was curious how you landed on the name.
Yeah. So to kind of touch on your first question there, a lot of people don't realize that every single product that leaves our shop and goes out the door to you, the customer, is hand built by one of two people. You know, there's no robots. There's no assembly line. It's one dude that looked at that bar that was like, this is badass. This is perfect. The customer will love this thing. So that's why we can warranty these things for life, as well as because that QC is so tailored, so tunnel vision, that these things are freaking perfect when they leave our shop. You know, like the pride of that product leaving, it's super important to us. And again, it's tying down to this. That's a real American person that is doing this. It's getting paid fairly, that it's not very common in the hunting industry, in any industry anymore, you know? So it took us a long time to get to that point to be able to figure out how to make money doing that. You know, it's not the easiest way, and we found it, and you know, we'll die on that hill. But
I like that. So I've always said that about bowstrings, right? So some of my very favorite bowstring builders are individuals.
Yeah.
And when their popularity grows, when they make a good product and more people start to find out about it, they get backlogged pretty bad. And it's hard to get like a good string built by those people. like in good time, but I'll almost always take a string that's built by some mom and pop where there's like one or two guys building every single strand, you know, putting the whole thing together, you know, measuring every single measurement in regards to that string, in comparison to like a manufacturer where you've got a bunch of people building strings and kicking them out the door. And I think, you know, there's some companies that make good strings like that, but I like that business model. Like I dig that shit. I love the fact that somebody's like hand building, putting those things together one by one. I love it. So I think it's cool. Commendable to you guys. I'm sure that's not easy.
Heck yeah. No, I mean, it's a challenge, and like the learning curve of training someone. Like I got freaking blessed with this kid that we found and brought on. Cause he's a 21-year-old kid that loves to work hard and loves to learn. Like that's not very common nowadays, you know, but he's a badass kid, and he's awesome. sick for bow hunting. Just like the rest of us are. So it's cool. And
cool.
And as far as the name Cutter Stabilizers, it started, you know, I got the spot and stock archery antelope bug real bad and got addicted to it. You know, it's just the terrain is so cool. It's that abstract beauty that you kind of have to spend time in it to see and to find that. You know, you go up to 12,000 feet and you're looking over this vast mountain range, like, yeah, it's badass, but you can see that shit from the highway. You know, you go out on the flat ground and you're like, well, this is boring. But then you get up and that first light cracks and there's birds making noise and there's these little tiny terrain features that you have to use. And the animals are so cool because they've been around. They're literally prehistoric, you know, so they're evolved to not die. And here we are hunting them with a freaking stick and string, you know.
Yeah. Are they your favorite game out? Are they your favorite to hunt?
It's getting really close. Whitetail is catching up very quickly. That's another bug that will get you really tight and not let go is the whitetail bug. But, you know, I tell people antelope hunting with a bow is kind of like sneaking up on your buddy in a parking lot and he's looking for you with binoculars.
Yeah, that's well put. Yep. Yeah, I agree. I'm not a very good spot and stock antelope hunter. I actually like, I think we talked about this last year at Tech. I like hunting them out of a blind on water. And I know that like some people call it cheating, but like I look at like my time. I love that time because I can sit. I've told people this before, but I love to like sit and read books. It's like I'll read more books in 5 days than I will the entire year on an antelope hunt. So I like sitting. I like watching them come in. I mean, you get a good tag in a state like Wyoming. I mean, you can sit there all day and look at 50 different antelope, you know?
Yeah.
So, but I have the same bug for the animal itself. Like the animal itself, I think, is one of the coolest animals there is. Like I think as far as like just pure aesthetics and, you know, just like you see those things on a ridge or a little hump in the morning and the sunlight just catches them and you got those black horns and their capes. I just think they're one of the coolest looking animals in North America for sure.
Oh yeah, definitely. Yeah. It's like I said, I got that whitetail bug pretty bad. So I do plenty of sitting and thinking, you know, we've got several properties in Nebraska and Texas that we hunt for whitetail. So I'm sitting and thinking for at least 40 days a year. So by the time August and September is over, I'm kind of done running around and I'm ready to just chill.
Yeah. No, I get that. Okay. Later on in the podcast, I want you to run me through like the products that you guys offer and kind of touch on that. But I did want to get into like just some principles of stabilization. Yep. Just, I think these are probably the most common types of questions that you get. Like what length should I shoot? What kind of weight should I shoot? So I kind of wanted to start there. So like first question for your average bow hunter, what do you think like stabilizers or what is a stabilization actually doing and what should they be looking for?
So let's talk about a dual stabilizer setup, because I think every single bow hunter should be using a dual stabilizer setup, a front bar and a back bar. The front bar's job is to slow down the visible movement of your pin on target at full draw. So the reason that that works is because we're making a lever that strategically puts mass weight out away from the bow. So that's all good. When we have accessories mounted on one side, we have our sight, we have our rest, we have the natural geometry of the riser, the bow is going to want to tip to that side. You know, generally it's the right side for a right-handed shooter. There's two ways to counteract that. We can apply a bunch of hand torque which is not repeatable, which is bad for tuning broadheads, which is bad for getting a good hole through paper. Or we can put a mechanical device that is the same all the time, that being a rear stabilizer. So it is meant to offset that weight left and right. What people don't think about as much is the forward to backward balance. So we get a front bar with a decent amount of weight that our pin float is good. And what you'll find is at full draw, your pin is getting stuck low below the target. You're fighting to push that pin up, you know, especially if we go uphill or downhill, which I hate to break it to you, but elk and mule deer don't live in flat ground, at least that I've found yet. So lots of uphill, downhill shots. And conversely, for a whitetail, every single shot from a tree stand is a downhill shot. So it's just as important for that. So adding weight to that back bar is going to naturally make that bow kind of act like a pendulum and push that pin upwards. It's much easier to let gravity help you than to fight gravity.
Yeah. I recently listened to another podcast, and I actually don't know, I don't remember when it was recorded, but the individual on it said that he thought because you're seeing most people shooting back bars now, right?
Yep.
So I think I went back through some photos. So the first time I ever actually hunted with a back bar would have been 2010. So that was a Matthews Drenaline LD. So it was a 37-inch axle-to-axle bow. I had a front bar and a back bar. And I think that was the first time I remember actually using a back bar in a hunting situation. But I was listening to this podcast, and this individual was like, he was saying he thinks that, you know, using a back bar for bow hunting, he's like, I think it's completely oversold. I think, you know, I think they push it. I don't think it's that important. I disagree, but I'm curious. It sounds like you do as well.
Yeah.
Do you think most people would benefit from using a back bar?
I think everyone should benefit from using a back bar. I mean, you look at target archery, how many of those guys are using a back bar? All
Everybody.
Of them. When you look at like gathering super technical specific data from shooting a bow, are they having, are they having some dude hold the bow, or are they putting in a shooting machine that's not applying torque, putting in a shooting machine? Mm-hmm. So the number one goal of building a legit killing hunting bow is forgiveness, right? So do I want to be thinking about what my bow hand is doing at full draw when I have a 330-inch bull at 20 yards away? No, I do not. I want to be thinking about, where's my arrow going to go? Am I going to watch this bull die in sight? And, you know, that's the kind of stuff we should be thinking about. I don't want to be thinking about fundamentals when I'm on a hunt at full draw on an animal.
Yeah, you're not thinking about anything at that point. It's just repetition. I found anyway. I mean, I try. Like, it seems like every time I get into a shot situation where the animal's coming, and even if I've got time to kind of prep my mind for it, it seems like as soon as I start to draw my bow, it's like everything goes out the window. And it's just the times that I'm successful, I think most of it, I'm just relying on just shit tons of repetition.
Yep, absolutely.
Just repetition. So, and I agree. I think having a bow that's balanced, that stabilizes well, I think that's part of, you know, it increases your success, because it helps kind of level things out when your mind is the most scattered, when you're most amped up.
Definitely. And at this last TAC event, actually, my business partner, Brandon, he comes from the commercial real estate world. So different entire scene than what we're used to. He's blunt, to put it nicely, you know? So we're trying to explain the reasoning behind shooting two stabilizers. And he says this analogy. I'm like, that's freaking good. He says, can you drive a car with one eye? I said, yeah. It's probably easier if you drive with both open though, right?
Yeah.
So
for sure. Absolutely.
It's similar to that. And like from a fundamental standpoint of shooting a bow, one of the hardest things to teach to do correctly is that bow hand, how you hold the bow. It's really, really hard to teach how to do that properly. And if your bow is fighting you to do that even more so, it's going to be much harder to learn. So if we have a good zero point to start, why would you not, you know?
Yeah. I'm curious as to, when you set your bow up, a couple questions actually. So one, when do you, like if you're building a bow out, whether you just replace the strings or you got a brand new bow and you pulled it out of the box, at what point do you, you know, pop on your stabilizers and start tinkering with those in the bow build? The other question I would have for you is, have you played much with the different mounting holes on a bow riser. So a lot of the new bows I've noticed, you've got a lower riser mount on the back where you can mount your back bar bracket and you can mount your back bar. And then you've obviously got your front stabilizer mount, the front hole, which is typically higher up closer to the grip. And you have the option when you set up a bow, you can either riser mount that to the front hole, which will put your back bar kind of up level ish with your front bar. And then you could also mount it in the lower one. Have you tinkered with that to see like differences and preferences of which one you like and why?
I have. Yeah. So as far as like when I first get a bow, throw on my sight, throw on my rest. And from there, I'll get an initial, you know, tune to make sure that it should shoot a bullet hole. From there, I'll throw on my bars. Before I shoot through paper, I want to have bars on the bow to balance it correctly. Because again, hand torque, right? If I'm tuning the bow to shoot a good hole with hand torque, it's not going to do the same when I have bars on. So from the very beginning, all the accessories are going on. I'm throwing bars on, I'm shooting through paper, and I'm going from there. As far as the upper versus lower holes, it's, I'll tell you this, every single one of the seven guys that shoot Hoyts that are on our team, they're all using the standard mounting hole location rather than the lower hole. What they have told me, and I've had to try it to feel for myself, I shoot PSE, so we have a lower hole as well. With the bars mounted on the lower hole, there's this initial swaying of the bottom of the bow when you hit full draw, and then it kind of chills out. So when you think about when you add weight to something, it's going to carry momentum, right? The heavier something is, the longer it takes to slow down. The motorcycle versus a semi. So adding weight to the bottom of the bow during the most violent portion of the shot process, which is pulling the bow back, it's going to take longer to settle in. So how we counter that is by running the weight up on that standard hole and using a 10 degree down quick disconnect to angle that weight downward. The weight is still attached at the center point of the riser, but we're getting that lower center of gravity, which is going to actually make the bow settle quicker, if that makes sense.
Gotcha. So which is your preference?
I use the standard hole. I mean, before rear stabilizer holes existed on bows, we only had one option to mount them. It was off the front, right?
Yep.
So again, as long as it's not like Bowtex have a super duper low hole on the bow, for the back bar, the rear stabilizer is a little bit different because it's going with tension rather than against tension, if that makes sense, forward versus backward. It's going back in the direction of the tension. It's not as bad of a initial settle time to get that bow to sit. But I mean, that's my goal, is to generate that sight picture as quick as I possibly can, you know, from full draw to pin on the target to executing a good shot. As quick as I possibly can. You know, sometimes you don't have 10 seconds to shoot an animal. Sometimes you have five, you know, so I want to get that arrow on its way towards the target as quick as I possibly can. So on all my setups now, I'm using the standard hole for the front, and like on the PSEs, the hole is basically directly behind the front bushing. So they're essentially in line,
gotcha.
Which, I mean, I hate the game of picking brands because you like the brand. I think you should pick the brand that you shoot the best. And that's why I've landed where I have. You know, I get along with the cams, I get along with the geometry, and it gives me the speeds that I want. And that's kind of the three factors that you want.
The upper hole, lower hole is interesting because when bows first started, you know, utilizing, they would put in that lower bushing, you know, that lower hole for a back bar. I was just like, oh yeah, logically that makes sense. I get it. You know, to me, it looks a little bit cleaner, and you know, looks is whatever, but, I thought, you know, I can mount my back bar lower. And so as soon as bows started having that lower hole, I just started mounting my back bar bracket and then running my back bar lower and started shooting, got used to it. And then recently I watch a lot of target archery, and then I've got some buddies that are, you know, target archers that are a lot more, you know, way better than I'll ever be. But I start noticing that those guys are going back to mounting their back bar off that front hole, right? Like a traditional bow would. And I started seeing them do it in their target bows, and then I'm starting to see them use it in their hunting bows. And so I started tinkering around with it, same as you probably did. Hopefully everybody does, yeah, right? Yeah, so, yeah. But it was funny because it was like an epiphany to me. I was like, shit, that's what I used to do. I don't know why I ever like went away from it or didn't even think about it. But so I started playing with it. And to me, I guess the way I would, to me, what it feels like is if I mount that back bar up on the front, like higher, I feel like I can more quickly like recover to the target if I aim, because that point is closer to my grip. Right. Whereas if I put that back bar lower on the riser, it feels like it fights momentum or movement really well because it's low, and it's great when I get on target. But when I get off target, I feel like it's harder to actually move it. It's slower to move back onto target, if you will.
For sure.
And so I've tinkered with it. I've gone back and forth. I don't know where I'm ultimately going to land, but I think it's interesting to play with. So it's curious. I'm always curious to explore it with other people and why they decided to do what they did. So
yeah,
I appreciate you answering that.
Yeah.
One question I wanted to ask you was, when you set up your stabilizers, I hear people talk a lot. They say like, oh, you want to set it up so it like balances perfectly, right? So you want to adjust the, you know, the horizontal, the vertical of your back bar, you know, so it relates in conjunction with your sight, whether it's mounted on the side of your bow or if it's like integrated into the riser, like with a Matthews or some of the Picatinnys on a Hoyt. Is that how you approach your stabilizer setup? Is, do you want that bow to like balance in your hand, left to right, front to back? And do you want it to balance at rest? Do you want it to balance at full draw? Like, what's your approach to that?
Yeah. So as far as the left to right goes, I set my bow to balance perfectly left to right, kind of in between having the quiver on and having the quiver off. You know, I don't want to pull my quiver off when I'm hunting, and then all of a sudden my bow is crazy tipping towards the non-accessory side. I also don't want to have it balanced to not have a quiver on, and then I put the thing on there and it's tipping the other way. So I kind of get it to be right in between the two, left to right. I mean, we never know what that shot scenario is going to be like when we're hunting, you know, on like a whitetail specific or a ground blind specific type setup. When you know you're going to take the quiver off, maybe it's different. You know, maybe you err on the side of no accessories on the side of the bow, and it's balanced perfect from there. As far as the forward to backward balance, I'll kind of show you how I have mine set up. And you see that thing wants to tip back super hard.
Yep.
So the reason I do that is because I am really bad at getting stuck low. So
me too.
When I have a bunch of weight on the back, that shit don't happen anymore.
Yeah. How do you... And maybe we'll dive into this a little bit, but how do you achieve that? So are you lengthening the back bar? Are you adding more weight? Maybe you can talk a little bit, because this is a common question that I get, is do you have like a general rule of thumb is like weight ratios from your front to your back?
So a thing that we ask our customers all the time is, I say, do you want to have a lighter overall bow, or do you want to have a more compact overall bow? So stabilizers, at the end of the day, it's all about lever length, right? So if you want a lighter bow overall, you're going to go with longer bars. If you want a more compact overall bow, you're going to run more weight. It's just, there's only so many ways to get to that end point of doing that, you know? So generally I've got a pretty solid idea of what I like to run lengthwise. And I always advise people to use the longest bars that they feel comfortable using. So if you're from Texas and you sit in a ground blind every single day, every single sit of every single season, probably don't want to use a 15-inch bar. Trust me, I've done it. Mm-hmm. I could show you pictures of deer that died with that bar sticking out the window, but it's a little tight, you know? So I built my bow last year with a 12-inch bar on the front instead of a 15. I mean, I've got a 28-inch draw length. So, you know, the longer you get, the worse it gets, because you're just a bigger, longer dude in that blind. Mm-hmm. So either a 12 or a 15 is kind of my go-to on the front of the bow. The day that target archers start shooting 8-inch and 10-inch bars on the front of their bows, I might think about it differently, but I'm not going to shoot a 30-inch bar out in the woods. You know, it's not practical. And So I want the longest possible bars on the bow. I want the lightest possible bow, which is why I start with a carbon bow. You know, it's same thing like building arrows. You build an FMJ and you add components and you add weight to it. You get your FOC just how you like it. You have a 550 grain arrow, whether you like it or not. You start with a lighter carbon arrow and you can put that weight exactly where you want it to do something that is beneficial rather than just have a 9 pound hunting bow just because that's how it ends up being, you know. So long bars, light bow overall. I mean, I think my bows are somewhere between 6.5 and 8 pounds, depending on the bow that year. But yeah, so I 15 on the front, 10 on the back's kind of my go-to. I did that 12 inch and 8 inch last year, and I was running 3 more ounces of weight than with my normal setup. So generally 2 to 1 back weight to front weight is a good starting point. I'm a little bit more 3 to 1 because of my notorious nature to get stuck low. So last year I had 9 ounces on my back bar and 3 on the front. This year I have 6 on the back and 3 on the front. So we don't want to go too light on the front because then we don't have any mass weight to slow the pin down. So generally it's that back bar weight that's going to change. People are scared to run a bunch of weight on their hunting bows. I get it. But you look at a target setup, one of our guys in Texas is running 34 ounces on his back bar. It's insane. You know what I mean? Like, literally 2 pounds of weight is on that back bar. So like there's something to that, you know? And I mean, don't go crazy. I'm not telling you to put 2 pounds of weight on your hunting bow just because, but get it to where, here's a good test for you. So, I don't know if you guys preach about anything like max effective range or some way to figure out that formula. You know, for me, it's how far out can I effectively hold a 4-inch group every single time from cold out of the truck? You know, 4 inches is kind of that number for me. Go to a distance that's 2/3 of that. So if your max effective range is 60 yards, go to 40 yards, and that's where you should dial in that weight of your bow. So we want to watch for a couple things. We want to watch for how far does our pin wander from the center of that target that we're aiming at? How fast can it recover and go back into that kill zone? Do you have to fight it vertically? Do you have to fight it laterally? So there's a fair bit of self-awareness that's involved in getting this thing set up. You know, someone that doesn't know how to shoot a bow at all, are they going to be able to tell what they need? Probably not.
Probably not.
If you put a 16-year-old kid in a Ferrari and then you put him in a Lamborghini, he's going to be like, holy shit, these things are the coolest cars ever. Well, what was the difference? I don't know what was the difference. The color, one was red, one was yellow, you know? So it's, you got to take the time and figure out what you need and familiarize yourself with your equipment, familiarize yourself with your limitations. You know, putting bars on your bow is probably the only bolt-on solution to shooting your bow better. And, you know, aside from putting a sight on the bow, which, you know, you're going to have a sight on your compound bow. It just, it is what it is, you know. So that being said, putting bars on the bow and setting them up correctly, and trust me, I've seen plenty of setups that are not set up correctly. You know, going to tack, you see people with their back bars kicked out literally like 90 degrees from the riser of the bow. I'm like, let me help you.
It is funny. I've seen some funky ones too. You know, one of the funny, not funny, but the funkiest ones I've ever seen is do you know Kyle Wilkie? He's a Kuyu guy, shot for Hoyt. He hunted for a while with just a back bar, and it was kind of kicked out, like you're saying, at like a, I mean, really steep angle. And I remember thinking, man, that looks so funky, but the guy shoots so extremely well. I just remember thinking, how's he doing this, you know? But to that point, I just think it's so individual, and I think it's like you're saying, how would you know unless you try things, right? So I think you gotta be kind of have enough of a base that you can evaluate it and then try to figure out like what are my needs here? Am I a guy that like hangs low and can't get the pin up into the target, or am I a guy that struggles like left to right, you know? What can I do to adjust the angle of the back bar to actually help, you know, bring me over or help my grip, you know, help me get my pin up into the target. But yeah, I think that's the thing I would advise. I would be curious to know, but like typically I tell people when you buy a set of stabilizers, like buy the stabilizers. So buy the bars. I believe your guys's comes with 3 1-ounce weights. So, you know, buy the stabilizers with the 3 1-ounce weights, but buy like another 15 or 20 ounce weights. It might seem excessive, but I think it gives you the latitude to be able to like play with it and figure out what it is that you like.
For sure.
You know, do you like a 2-to-1 or a 3-to-1, you know, and you got to have enough weights and just enough time to tinker with it to kind of find out what suits you best.
Yep.
So I always tell people buy extra weights.
Yeah, for sure. And a cool thing about one of the products that we offer is we have these, one piece 6-ounce weights. So if you need to add weight in a hurry, you have the option to, oh, there's 6 ounces right there. Of course you lose the adjustability to add or remove weights, obviously, because you have that one piece, but it's 8 to 9 times out of 10, you're going to have at least 6 ounces on that back bar to get the bow holding how it should.
Yeah. What does your sight picture look like when you've got your bow set up, you got it tuned, you've got your stabilizers where you think you want them? Like, can you explain to me like what your sight picture looks like or what it should look like?
Yeah. So essentially my little process that I do, and I still work one day a week at a pro shop here in Denver, just cause I'm sick for it. I love that side of it. I love educating, but
somebody reached out to me and they were like, oh, I saw you guys are carrying cutter stabilizers. He's like, that guy works at my local pro shop.
Yep.
He's like, yep, that guy's awesome. And I was like, oh, you're a bow tech then. Yep. I knew that you were obviously a bow tech, because anybody that has dove deep into stabilizers like you are, I'd assume you probably do all your own work, but you're still working.
Yeah. So at a bow shop, out of the machine shop, and I went into the archery tech world. And then so much time of that, you got to move on sometimes, you know, but, 5 days a week is a lot different than one day a week with that. So I'm absolutely able to go in there with a fresh perspective of these people are here because they want to be successful. So, going back to the sight picture though, I have my process. I start from my feet. I work my way up. So I say in my head, feet, knees, hips, shoulders, I want a straight line all the way up. Setting my bow hand before I draw the bow back. That one's huge. You see it all the time. People draw the bow and then they make all these crazy adjustments to try to get their grip right. And I mean, you're adding a shit ton of hand torque when you do that at full draw. So getting everything set, drawing the bow back, anchor first, then acquire your peep sight. Your bubble should be in the middle from there. It should be done. As far as getting the pin on the target, I have a cue in my head that I've found over the past couple seasons that's helped me a ton, and that's to kind of think about pushing the bow away from me with that front shoulder. You know, you get, that's another thing, his front shoulder elevating all the time, which is, it's not a structurally stable position. It's also one of the hardest things to learn from shooting a bow. So I have this like little quick second of pin on the target, start to push towards the target, and then that pin just kind of locks in, and you've got kind of a, you know, a 4 to 7 second window of that pin is right there. And it's, I don't want to go down another rabbit hole, but it's not rushing that. It's making sure that you're executing your shot. You're not stopping and starting, and just trusting that if that pin does move a little bit, you're not going to shoot the fucking deer in the foot. You know what I mean? Like, it's probably going to be fine. Like, so having that little clock that goes off, and the shot should be gone by the end of that clock. Otherwise you start to think about your breathing. You start to think about all this other crap that you shouldn't be thinking about. And, you know, by then the arrow should be gone. The bubble is locked in the middle right when you hit full draw, essentially is what I want. And then it's just that little input of pushing towards the target to increase that tension, and that came from shooting a target bow.
Yeah. Do you come down from the top on your aim, or do you try to, you know, draw your bow level as you possibly can, and then, you know, put your pin to the target? Or do you come from a left or a right?
Generally, I try to draw as level as I can. We don't always have that luxury when we're shooting uphill or downhill. But if I can, I'm trying to, basically it's like if you were to shoot a recurve, you want to like burn a hole in that spot you want to hit before you pull the bow back. So I kind of start off by looking at exactly where I want to aim and then draw the bow and get that pin there as quick as I can. So, I'm not coming down from the top, for the most part, or any, either side. I try to get it there as level as I can.
What's your pin float look like in a bow that's the proper draw length for you? It fits you well. It's repeatable. It's comfortable. And then you've got it, you know, set up with your stabilizers. You know, does your pin float look? Cause I mean, here's the thing is like, I was shooting with, you know, a coworker in Vegas, and he was asking me the other day, he's like, man, I just can't get my pin to hold steady. And I was like, yeah, no shit. nobody can. Yeah. Like nobody can. I don't know anybody that can, you know, burn their pin into the center of the target and it just sits there.
I know one guy.
really? Gosh. I don't know anybody that can think of like,
I've recorded him at full draw, and he's like, yeah, that pin was moving a bunch. I was like, dude, you look like a statue. What do you mean it's moving?
Yeah.
It's crazy. My pin float generally is going to, it's up and down, more down than up again, which is why I have my bow set up the way I do. And then it'll kind of J hook up to the right. So it's essentially a little circle. And again, when you add tension into the bow, all those things are going to tighten up and get smaller, which, again, shoot a target bow with a target cam and then go shoot your hunting bow. You'd be like, oh my gosh, this is easy. You know, 65% let off is a different animal than 80 or 85% let off. It's, you have to have tension. Otherwise it's taking you for a ride.
Yeah. I was going to ask you, actually, that's a good lead into the next question. Do you set your bow, your stabilizer set up differently for different let off? So if you've got a high let off cam, you know, some of these bows will, you know, have let off of like 85 or 90% even. Do you do anything different in that type of bow in terms of weight that you put on your stabilizers versus a, you know, a cam that's maybe 80% or 75 or 65?
I just always shoot 80%. I think the little bit of extra holding weight is keeps me honest, keeps me in the shot a little bit more.
Gotcha. Even on a target bow?
Target bow, no, target bow I shoot 70%. So, I mean, it's a completely different animal, and the way that I have my target bow set up is when you pull, sometimes as a right-handed shooter, the harder you pull, the more left it takes you. So I have that bar kicked in a little bit more to keep that weight, towards the accessory side of the bow. Just because I pull really hard on my target bow. I also have, like we talked about earlier, I have my back bar up a little bit higher. And then I actually have one of those 1-piece 6-ounce weights screwed directly into the riser on the bottom hole. So it's like hanging a water bottle from your tripod, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, man, there's so many different ideas and options that you can kick around. I noticed, like, for me, if I'm shooting a bow with less let off, it feels like I kind of need to like weight that bow up a little bit more, you know? I don't know why exactly. There's probably some physics involved in that off the top of my head I can't come up with, but it seems like the more let off I can get off, I can get away with like a little bit less weight. I don't know. That's interesting. But I think you just go back to playing with it. Just trying different things that work. I mean, to hear you that you screw an extra 6 ounces just directly into the riser, I'm sure that just came from you tinkering. Mm-hmm.
Yep.
Right?
Yeah, I did for sure. Yep. It was just, you know, there's too much weight on the front, made me start dipping down, too much weight on the back, made me start missing out the top. So I was moved it in towards the riser and just increased the mass weight of the bow itself rather than pushing it out away from the bow. But yeah, exactly. Just take principles of a general good starting point so you don't get overwhelmed, but give yourself the tools to be able to tinker at the same time. So most people that we talk to, that we interact with, they haven't had a well set up stabilizer set up on their bow before. So they put the bars on the bow. I mean, we see it all the time. We do demos, attacks, and you know, you bring them over to the practice range. And after that first arrow, they look back at you like, what the hell have you been gatekeeping from me? I'm like, dude, yeah. I don't want to gatekeep from you. I want you to shoot well, be successful.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Run us through your product lineup. So from a carbon standpoint, you hear a lot of talk of like super stiff carbon, you know, high modulus carbon, you know, different stiffnesses. So run us through like what carbon you guys use and why, and what does it do for the stabilizer itself?
Yeah. So our hunting lineup is a high mod carbon. Essentially, it's the stiffest carbon you would want in a hunting bar before you start getting that like snap of feedback. Our target bars are mm-hmm. ultra high mod carbon, and they're a thicker wall. So you put 2 pounds of weight on a 15 inch back bar, you probably need a stiffer bar. But as far as the hunting stuff goes, it's a high mod carbon. It's the second stiffest possible carbon that you can have. And then inside of all of our carbon tubes, we put our vibration dampening material. So it's inside of the tube. We didn't go through all the trouble of making a micro diameter bar to put a big giant rubber thing on the outside of it, you know? So that's kind of how we build our hunting bars. We have a 6, 8, 10, 12, and 15-inch bar in the hunting lineup. Target bars start at 12 and 15, and then you go 24, 26, 28, and 30 for the target stuff. Again, it's all 100% American-made, which unfortunately most target guys don't seem to really care about because I don't think they're used to having that as an option.
Right.
As far as the weights go, through our website, you can purchase them with 3 individual 1 ounce weights or 6 individual 1 ounce weights. So that's always an option to have those at your disposal. Then we have the 1-piece 6 ounce weights for our front quick disconnects. We have a straight and a 10 degree down. And then one cool thing about our front QDs is they allow you to store your bar vertically, keeping it attached to the bow in your pack, in your case. Yeah. So when you're hiking in, when it's in your case, when you're pulling your bow up a tree, if you're whitetail hunting, you're not having to pull super duper fast when your bow is pointing the right direction. And then our back bar bracket, our CB Pro, which is the second version of our back bar bracket. It's actually built a little bit differently than most on the market. So most are going to use a compression style, which is a round peg, a round hole with the clamp. Put enough torque on them, they're always going to move. We went with a spline system, so it looks like a CV axle on a vehicle. You have a male spline and a female mm-hmm. spline that interlock with that screw on the outside. So you need to loosen that screw 3 full turns from tight, give that bracket room to disengage, and then you can make your adjustments. So you get the benefit of easy adjustment and rock solid positioning, meaning you're not going to lose your place unless that screw literally completely falls out. And if you don't realize that that happened, then probably a little bit oblivious to that.
Run me through quick disconnect. So you've got a standard straight quick disconnect, and then you got a 10 degree, yep. right? I see a lot of guys shooting 10 degree. I think you got one there yep. on your bow. What does a 10 degree, what does that do for you?
So the 10 degrees, originally they kind of came from the target world. You have a 30 inch front bar mm-hmm. that's sticking out straight from the bow. It can be visible at full draw and maybe a little bit distracting in your sight picture. That was kind of the origin of it. Kind of like we talked about earlier with the upper and lower hole, you're kind of cheating the system with a 10 degree down, meaning you're putting the weight lower. So you lower the center of gravity, which in turn can let you use a little bit less weight on the back bar. The lever, if you will, is still coming from the center point of the bow, but the weight is down lower. Aside mm-hmm. from that, you're not generally going to see a huge benefit from anything shorter than a 12 inch bar on a 10 degree down. So, we've seen a big bump gotcha. In sales numbers from straights to the 10 degree, also in bar length. And I think people are starting to realize that you know, your arrow sticks out past farther than your stabilizer ever will. And, you know, I say it all the time, if I'm worried about a 15 inch bar squeezing through a tight spot in the brush, then I probably don't want to try to fit my body through that either, you know? So,
right.
The,
yeah. To me, a 10 degree kind of the thing that I noticed the most, I don't know if it's a placebo or not, but it feels to me like as you come to full draw, a 10 degree disconnect will kind of take some of that initial waggle out of my bow, you know, like that initial, just like little rocking motion. If you've got that stabilizer mounted straight out of the riser, you get a little bit of it. And it seems like to me that 10 degree will kind of take most of
that. And you're talking
out.
About
so it seems like it,
this,
yeah.
not
yeah,
this.
Yeah, this. Mm-hmm. Yep.
So,
yeah, it's kind of that rocking in your grip, if you will.
Yep. That way that the weight is below the point of force, which is your hand.
Yep.
Definitely.
Yeah. That's kind of what I've noticed. What, you guys do the whole tack circuit, right? So you've been on the road probably
Not
quite a
the
bit.
Whole thing.
You guys have a booth at every one of those?
That's too much. We do. we had five on the schedule for this year, and we're actually only going to end up doing four. So we did San Antonio, Pennsylvania, we'll do South Dakota and Colorado. We were going to do the Upper Peninsula one in Michigan in August, and then we saw that it was a 4-hour drive from the airport to the venue. I was like, it's the second year that they've had that event. Like, I don't want to drive 8 hours in 3 days and then not make my money back, you know? So, I mean, it's an undertaking for us. You know, we're selling through somewhere between 70 and 100 bars in 3 days. And like I said, we're building these things by hand, you know? So to have inventory ready to go for that, I did back to back ones last year, and that was the last time we'll do back to back tack events. I mean, we built 114 bars in 18 hours last year, and it was a shit show. Yeah.
Gotcha.
We were tired.
Have we kind of covered the most common questions that you
for
get
sure.
from
yep.
most folks?
Yeah.
Gotcha. Yeah. I think probably a lot of people who just want to, it is different. Like if you haven't explored stabilizers, especially a back bar and like moving weight up and down, like just getting a chance to put it on your bow and play with it, it's real eye opening for most folks.
Oh yeah, definitely. Yeah. And, I mean, aside from that, like our Versa stand has done really good. It's like a universal bow stand essentially for the guys that don't have the Matthews or the Hoyt stuff. And I mean, it's essentially like a little baby bipod, you know, so you have those adjustable length legs, you can keep your cam out of the dirt. We'll get to the quiver here in a minute, but that's I'm stoked about that thing. It's so cool.
Yeah, do you have one? Can we check it out and see what you got?
So it's a one piece four arrow. The whole assembly is 7.6 ounces all in.
Okay.
Same carbon as our hunting bars, so it's a high mod carbon. It's internally vibration dampened, just like the hunting bars. The hood is a 3D printed carbon fiber, which I didn't know was an option until just recently. It's freaking cool.
I just found that out right now.
Yep. So yeah, I'll kind of work my way down. You know, we got the loop to hang it up. Our foam hadn't really seen any changes in quiver foam for a long time. So we had to address that too. So we went with the 3-stage foam. So the outer layer is a little bit stiffer, a little bit more rigid. It's got, I don't know if you could see, but it's got this like big, like star cut shape in it, which is meant to help you align your broadhead in low light. The mid layer is a little bit softer for retention, for vibration dampening. It's got that like standard broadhead wrench style pattern with the X with the two little legs. And then the upper layer is that stiff stuff again. So you're not jamming your points into the top of the hood and dulling out the points.
Does it work both for a mechanical and a fixed blade?
Yep.
I'd assume.
Yep. So moving down the adjustments, you have a up and down. So you can slide this bracket all the way up and down. You have in and out.
Gotcha.
And then you have two different options for holes to slide this on a dovetail. And then you have an aluminum thumb knob there. Kind of the most badass thing is this gripper. So this is our unigripper. Essentially, you can fit a 4 mil, a 5 mil, a standard diameter arrow into this thing without changing any grippers or anything like that. So think like those wall mounted broom hangers that are, you know, tension like that. It's very similar to that. So, I mean, gone are the days of, well, I'm shooting a 6 mil arrow this year, I'm going to shoot a 4 mil arrow next year. Like, your grippers aren't getting stretched out. You're not having to change stuff. You're not having to adjust anything. So it's all there, ready to go, without making any adjustments.
You used it with a hip quiver, like a Total Peep hip quiver attachment?
You just need to mount the mounting bracket onto it, just the same as the other ones.
Gotcha.
But yeah, it's cool, man. I'm stoked about it. And I mean, I think the production version is like version 14 of prototyping. So yeah.
Yeah. That's such a pain in the ass. That R&D is such a pain in the ass, but man, it's really good to hear that you're that far down the road.
Yeah.
If you're a few years and 14 different versions, I feel like you give the consumer confidence that they can take it into the field and, you know, reliably know that it's been tested.
I mean, with that gripper, like, nobody's ever done it before, and halfway through the development stage, we were like, oh, I see why no one's done this shit before. Like, this is really hard.
It's funny you say that. I've got three different arrows in my hip quiver upstairs that I've been just playing with. So I've got 5 mils, I've got 4.5s and fours. So I've got, three different millimeters of arrows, all different weights that I've been just tinkering with and tuning with. I have tinkeritis pretty bad. So I'm always playing with some different weights and speeds and just tinkering. Yep. But that's a cool feature that you can go back and forth between the two. One of the biggest beefs I've always had with most quivers is that, like, if you shoot a mechanical, like a Sever or Rage or something, you can get the point in typically to, like, you know, the receiver portion of it, but then you've got the blades that don't really have anything that kind of hold it in. Right. So if you don't have those blades completely, like, seated, so like a Sever, you know, they use those little silicone bands to hold the blades in. I always use two silicone bands around each broadhead just to cut down the rattle, you know, that noise. So hopefully this quiver will kind of address that. Like the broadhead will maybe go a little bit deeper and hold those blades in place, or at least the fins.
Yeah, I do.
You know?
So the mid layer foam that has that broadhead wrench cut, each of those little legs of the cut is, I think they're 45 thou thick. So most of those mechanical broadheads are using a 35 or a 40 thou thick blade. So it's just enough to hold it tight, but not be a pain in the ass to get it in there. I mean, I missed the opportunity at a really freaking big deer because I pulled my broadhead out of the quiver and it was open and I got to full draw and I didn't see that. And it was 60 yard shot in the wind. I was like, I better not shoot that, which was a sad day. It was a sad day. It was 5 degrees outside with the wind chill that day.
Ugh. Yeah, we went to New Zealand here a few weeks ago, and I know a couple times I looked in my quiver, like, of an evening, you know, kind of getting ready for bed and just put my gear away, looked, and a couple of my broadheads had opened, you know. And then I sat there the next morning and put new silicone bands on them and kind of tucked them back in, which is a downfall of a mechanical. I get it, but I could see that being an issue.
No, I'm a mechanical guy through and through, so I'm with you.
Yeah. Yeah, I've gone both ways. I hunted with fixed blades forever and ever and had a lot of good luck with them. Admittedly, a little finicky to tuning and torque, you know. It felt like if things weren't exactly perfect, you may not get the best flight. And then I killed a lot of animals, but I never got great blood trails. And then I started using mechanicals again on the recommendation from a buddy, and I just have felt like they are more accurate. I think they're a little more forgiving, and I feel like my blood trails have generally been better. So that's interesting. I've had you for almost an hour, so I'm going to cut you loose here in a sec, but if you had to just, like, wrap up stabilization in a bow, like, what are your takes?
So number one, go with the longest bars that you feel comfortable shooting. Buy extra weight, and get a front bar, back bar setup. You will not go back once you start with the front bar, back bar setup. The added weight to the bow is not nearly enough to make it a penalty for going with that, for the accuracy gain and the forgiveness that you're going to gain from doing that. And If you do have the option to support American manufacturing, go to cutterstabilizers.com and support American manufacturing, support our economy, support our jobs, and keep everything countryside.
That's awesome. I appreciate you you jumping on and give me an hour. Like I said, on short notice, I think I hit you up yesterday.
Yeah. So it's all good, dude.
Thanks for doing that.
I love talking about this stuff.
What tax are you going to be at next?
You're going to be in Salt Lake? We're not doing Salt Lake. That one was, it was weird. Okay. It was, I don't know if you guys saw it too, but it was so slow for the amount of people that were there. And I don't know if it was where we were at with the booth, but I don't know, dude. I mean, for 8 hours to drive out there from Denver here is kind of a bummer. So we'll do South Dakota.
No, I get it. Utah's just weird, man. I'm from Utah. I'm sitting in Southern Utah as I speak. I grew up here. Utah's a strange place.
It is. Yep.
So I get it.
I wanted to say the event was weird, not the people, but you said it first.
I'll say it. The people, the event. Yep. We're just weird.
It's all good, man. It's all good.
Cool. So South Dakota.
That's next weekend, I think, and then Colorado mid-July, and then time to go kill shit after that.
Yeah, did you draw any tags this year?
I got 3 tags here in Colorado. I got a Eastern Plains archery deer tag. I got a Season's Choice whitetail only tag. Drew a pretty decent archery antelope tag. We'll do over the counter for elk, and then because I'm a resident, and then then we'll do Nebraska for deer. That's gonna be a badass hunt. We got I'm gonna take a few buddies out there to this public spot that I found, and we're just gonna slum it in the Dirtbag Motel and try to kill some deer.
That's awesome. I'm kind of pissed. I think this will, unless I can pull some, a rabbit out of a hat, I don't think I'll have an antelope tag this year for the first time in a hot minute. I had points that I could draw in Wyoming, and I held off on that because I was wanting to go with a buddy. And then Lorenzo, actually, that works here, he ended up drawing a deer tag that starts essentially the same time we would go up and bow hunt them. So I was like, I'll wait for a year. So I didn't apply for that. And then I started looking at Idaho, and I ended up applying for a unit that I had like 47% odds. And I thought, shit, 1 out of 2, that ain't bad. I got to draw one of those, right? Oh for three yesterday. Yeah. So no antelope, no deer, no elk in Idaho for controlled. And so now I'm looking at like secondary draws in, Colorado or Nevada, and just kind of hoping I can pull a rabbit out of the hat. But it's going to really bum me out if I don't have an antelope tag.
I'll tell you, if you want to come out to Colorado, I'll put you on, and you can hustle, hustle with the OTC boys out here.
Yeah. I might hit you up if it comes down to it. Cause I've got 3 elk tags. Yeah, so I got plenty of elk tags. Yeah, but it's not an antelope.
What are you going to do in August? Twiddle your thumbs, play with your bow.
That's exactly where I'm at. That's what's really at night when I lay there in bed. And what really gets to me is the fact that like August will hit mid August and I won't be out bow hunting something.
I get it, dude.
Yeah. So I might
see that thermometer.
I might take you up on
100 degrees. You're like, man, I want to go walk around in this right now.
What's wrong with us, man?
It's terrible. It's the best. It's the most fun.
Yeah, no, I get it. So you guys can follow, people can follow Cutter on Instagram. Do you guys have a YouTube channel? Anything like that
it's
you do?
Crazy.
Anything else?
I've got a pretty full schedule with friends that drew good tags this year that I'm going to go film for. One of my buddies drew a Unit 1 archery tag, so I've heard that's kind of like Jurassic Park up there, so that should be pretty damn cool.
Yep. Yeah, and it'll probably be the only chance you ever get to actually be in that unit and hunt around.
Yeah,
I
just burned 12 points last year, so I'm done until I'm an old man probably.
Yeah. I burned mine last year too, and then with their draw changing, maybe in 2028 there in Colorado, I don't know what the future of it's going to look like for opportunities. It'd be interesting to see. Yeah. Well, right on, Earl, man. I appreciate it. I'll cut you loose. If people are looking, you guys can visit their website, Cutter Stabilizers and Buy Stabilizers. As I mentioned earlier in the podcast, we now have a couple different, we have different lengths. We also have a couple different colors. So I think we have the black and the pine green. I don't even know that you noted that, but you guys make different colors, right? So if you want to match your bro,
we got five different colors.
And those are all Cerakoted,
right?
Everything
except for the black is Cerakoted. The black is a hard anodized.
Right on. Yep. So visit our gear shop, visit your guys' website. I appreciate you jumping on. I like what you guys are doing. Like I said, I love shops like yours that are, you know, doing things the way that they want to do it. I think it's really cool that you guys are hand building those in the United States. Okay. I think it's awesome.
Yeah. I appreciate you having me on.
Keep on, man. We'll touch base. Hopefully, follow along with how you did at the end of the year and we'll stay in touch. Okay. Yep, thanks, Earl. Have a good one. Yep. Bye.